Well, welcome. I am Lynn Willis. I taught pharmacology for 30-some years at Indiana University. I came by way of that degree by first as getting a bachelor's degree in pharmacy, but then went on to get the PhD in pharmacology and have had an abiding interest in over-the-counter drugs and dietary supplements and the like for probably most of the time that I was teaching pharmacology to medical students, as well as dental and nursing students. At one point in my life, I wrote a newspaper column on this subject, and I'm thinking about it right now. I didn't get picked up by the Seattle Times for a regular column, but they did run a week's worth of my columns one time, probably before some of you were born. But there, in that arena, I learned a lot about sort of what we might call the fringes of over-the-counter non-prescription medication. And that piqued my interest even more. And so I've had this interest for quite some time. I always like to start this kind of a talk off by referring to one of the grand old men of medicine, Sir William Osler. He's really the father of internal medicine in this country. And he has a quote that he uttered somewhere around the turn of the 19th century, but it's quite apropos today. The desire to take medicine is perhaps the greatest feature which distinguishes man from animals. And I think there's a lot of truth to this. I also learned some time back that it helps to bring a little humor into a gathering like this and to do it at the beginning, just in case none of it shows up during the course of the talk. And I was just thinking here, we've been in some of the Bible studies, we've been talking about, or really the philosopher, Mike, has been doing a thing where folks that he's been talking about in the movies have been confronting evil and confronting death, and got me to thinking a little bit about death. And I was reminded of a friend of mine who said at one time, he said he hoped that he would die quietly in his sleep, like his grandfather did, and not screaming and yelling and terrified in a horrible moment of panic like the people in the car that he was driving. So, well, with great success like that, I'll try one more. So this guy shows up at the pearly gates, and St. Peter says, you are newly arrived, and I have to ask you before I can let you in. This is not very Lutheran, but I have to ask you if you've done anything good that would merit your immediate entry into heaven. And he said, I was once involved in a situation where I walked into a bar just about the time to see a bunch of bikers off in one corner accosting a young woman and pushing her around and making lewd advances and just being obstreperous and out of place. And I walked up to them and I said, stop that right now. If you don't stop it, I'm going to mop up the floor with you and we'll be done with this. And St. Peter said, well, that's very impressive. When did this happen? He said, about a minute and a half ago.
That's good.
So, okay. So, let's press on here. Now, one thing I always like to do, first I want to ask, were any of you here for the Monday class? One, okay. Maybe you'll remember some of what we'll cover, at least in the early stages here. Then the other is, are there, in the new group that's arrived, are there any health professionals?
Public health.
Public health, great, okay. Okay, we've had nurses and PAs and a chiropractor here this week, and it's all made for a good discussion. Okay. Now, what I want to talk about tonight with you, and I emphasize that I would like to run this as informally as we can. In other words, if you have a question, if you want to take issue with something I've said, you want some clarification on something I've said, just pipe up, raise your hand, whatever, to get my attention, and we'll stop and we'll talk about whatever it is that's on your mind. I've got tomorrow yet to finish out the whole series here, and so if we don't make it all the way through everything that I had planned for tonight, that's fine. So we'll just see where this goes. Now, there are, in the realm of non-prescription drugs, there are, in this country, basically three categories of non-prescription drugs. And one of these categories is what I would call conventional over-the-counter drugs, Tylenol, Maalox, the stuff that you see most readily when you walk into your neighborhood pharmacy or your Walmart or one of these places and you go into the pharmacy area. Those would be conventional over-the-counter drugs. And just differentiate, now they're all over-the-counter drugs. That means they can be bought but without a prescription. But for purposes of classification, then I divide them this way. I next have a group that I call dietary supplements and herbals. And that's what we're going to focus on tonight. And then there's also a category known as homeopathic drugs. Now, is anybody here who knows what homeopathic is? Okay, one person. We didn't have anybody yesterday. Two, okay.
Sort of.
Great, okay, good. Well, good. Most people don't know what homeopathy is. And under ordinary circumstances, I, as a pharmacologist, wouldn't be too concerned about that, except when I walked into my neighborhood Walgreens back in Indianapolis. No, it was a CVS. And I just strolled down the cold medicine aisle just to see what was there as I was getting ready for my trip out here. Here, side by side with the conventional medicines, were homeopathic medicines. And that may be okay, but for a consumer who doesn't understand how homeopathic remedies differ both pharmacologically and legally from conventional over-the-counter drugs and from dietary supplements, then the consumer is at a disadvantage. And my objective with presenting a week's worth of discussions like this is to turn things around so that the advantage goes to the consumer and that the consumer understands what they're looking at when they see this bewildering array of products that are on the shelves and on the internet and in the newspapers that are purporting to take care of what ails you. So tonight we're going to focus on dietary supplements and herbals. We'll make some forays back into conventional over-the-counter drugs. I've been talking about specific kinds of over-the-counter remedies the last couple of days. And we still have a few that I would like to go through. We may get to some of them tonight. If we don't, we'll get to them tomorrow. We won't be talking about homeopathic remedies specifically tonight. The issue that confronts you as consumers is that there are basically two laws, there are two laws in this country that regulate non-prescription drugs. There is the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, which has been amended several times up into the 1970s and maybe even beyond, I don't know for sure. And that regulates prescription-only and conventional over-the-counter drugs. And the way that these drugs are regulated is highly regimented, and the control here is substantial compared to the situation for dietary supplements and herbal medicines, which are covered under a different law, still administered by the Food and Drug Administration, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. We've only had this since 1994. And we have it because the FDA was becoming so concerned in the early 90s about the influx of dietary supplements coming in to the country from out of the country. For the most part, some were being manufactured in this country, I think, at that point, but there was a lot of them that were coming in from outside, and there was great concern because they were being promoted as drugs. They're basically being promoted as drugs, but they are, but they were not drugs in the sense that that this law defines them, and therefore there was no coverage for them. And the FDA had just about had it, and they put out an announcement that said, we're going to ban the importation of all of this stuff because it's just, we're getting dangerous things in here and we just can't keep control of it. Well, the manufacturers of these things in this country and even elsewhere went through the roof, of course, as did the public who had become enamored of these substances and wanted to have access to them. And I believe that announcement by the FDA generated more letters coming to the FDA and to Congress than anything had up to that time. The net effect of this was that Orrin Hatch and I forget who now, Orrin Hatch of Utah and somebody else put through this law. This is a problematic law, which I hope that you'll understand as we get into this. And it's problematic from the standpoint both of the FDA and for you. You still have a problem as consumers here because of what this law does not do compared to what this one does. And I'll expand on that. For homeopathic remedies, just to complete the triad here, they are covered under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, but they're mostly exempt from any of the requirements that are associated with prescription and conventional over-the-counter drugs. Now, I have to point out that at the time this law was first enacted, we did not have prescription drugs. Everything was available over-the-counter, and it was only until 1954 that drugs that were coming along after the World War II boon in chemistry and the drug industry we're beginning to be curative for conditions and helpful in conditions that ordinary people would not be expected to diagnose themselves. And these were drugs that were potentially far more dangerous than the other drugs that had been on the market. That's when the government made this distinction between prescription only and non-prescription drugs. What's pertinent for our discussion is that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act requires proof of safety and effectiveness for conventional over-the-counter drugs, but they don't have the manpower, they don't have the finances to assure that all of the over-the-counter drugs that are coming on and have been on the market are indeed fully safe and efficacious. They have to set a priority, and their priority, as far as drugs are concerned, is first with prescription drugs because they're potentially more dangerous. But there is, and they've been reviewing over-the-counter drugs since 1974, and they've been going through every classification of over-the-counter medication, and through that examination, some have been pulled off the market, some have changed in the formulation of what actual drugs are in there. The definition of drugs that now are considered safe and effective for various conditions has been refined and narrowed. There are far fewer drugs now on the market, on the over-the-counter market for conventional drugs than there were, say, in 1970. But there's still a good number of them. The Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, by contrast, does not require proof of safety or efficacy for dietary supplements and herbals. That's because they define dietary supplements and herbals as foods. That law looks at these things as foods. And foods, you know, we wouldn't eat foods that were poisonous. And so So these items are generally, they're in a category that's known as generally recognized as safe, GRAS. And so it's not required of manufacturers of the dietary supplements to demonstrate that they're safe to the satisfaction of the FDA. And efficacy is not an issue because these are foods, they're not drugs. And so there is no point in asking for proof of efficacy. However, as we'll see, and I'm sure you're all aware of this, many of the dietary supplements that are on the market, and certainly many of the herbal medicines, are promoted as drugs. They're promoted to intervene in some potentially serious pathological conditions. Homeopathic remedies, by comparison, are exempted from showing proof of efficacy and safety, and there's a reason for this, which we'll talk about tomorrow. So I'm hoping you're beginning to see the problem here, that if we've got substances on the market that are being promoted as medicinal agents, as drugs, and only some of them are being held to a standard of a demonstration of safety and efficacy, there's a problem. And as my wife, the psych nurse, would always tell me when I was complaining about something, she'd say, well, whose problem is it? And this is your problem to sort out what's good and what's not good in this context. And it's not easy to get the right kind of information to help you make your decisions when you are looking at the purchase of say, one of these dietary supplements. Now, in trying to understand the context of over-the-counter drugs and dietary supplements within the realm of pharmacology, I have some principles that I always inflict upon my medical students right on the first day of class, just to drive home some basic fundamental points. The first of these is that all drugs are poisons. There's nothing. And I extend this to any substance that we would consume, that we would put into our bodies, even water, that cannot hurt us. Water can kill you if you drink too much water in too short a time. And so the notion here, do not listen to anyone who tells you that their product is completely safe, that their product has no side effects. Just turn away and go look somewhere else, because that's completely flat wrong. It's wrong because all substances are poisons, potentially, and it's wrong because no drug has only a single action. When you take an aspirin to treat your headache, if you're like everybody else, and I'm no different, my thought is on that headache, and I'm thinking of the aspirin as taking care of that headache. I'm not thinking of what else the aspirin might be doing. Aspirin is interfering with the ability of my blood to clot. Aspirin is changing, potentially, the control mechanism for body temperature, if I happen to have an elevated body temperature. Aspirin can interfere with mechanisms that produce inflammation. And there are other things that aspirin can do. What a drug like aspirin or any drug can do depends on how much of the drug has been taken. Whether or not a drug, for example, an antihistamine such as the antihistamine Benadryl, diphenhydramine. How many of you have taken Benadryl? Yeah. Sure. Nearly everybody has taken Benadryl. Did it make any of you drowsy?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Okay. Now, that's because that's one effect. The other effect is you probably took it because you had allergies, or you took it because you had a cold. There's three things that drug is doing. It's interfering with an allergic reaction, if there was one going on. It's making you drowsy, and it's drying up secretions. If you've got a runny nose, it can help to dry up some of these secretions. So there's three effects right there. If you were to push that dose, it would blur your vision. It would also interfere with the ability of your lens and your eye to focus on near objects. So Those are actions that are related to how much of the drug is given. I always ask my medical students, I don't show them what's in red when we go through this. I make them guess what I'm thinking. And the I say, what is the proper dose of a drug? Well, the proper dose of a drug is whatever it takes to produce the effect that you want. That's really the proper dose. And we've discussed this week that there are ways in which you can have control over the dosage of even these over-the-counter medicines if you take whatever you're going to be taking. If it's available in a liquid form, you're able to titrate your dosage a little bit better than you can necessarily with tablets. But these are the principles that should be rolling around in the back of your mind and tucked away when you are beginning to think about having to go to the drugstore and make sense out of what they've got there to offer. It's also helpful to understand what's happening in the body when we take medications. After that drug has found its way into, let's just say, into our stomach, it gets absorbed. It immediately, when it gets absorbed, it goes into the bloodstream. That circulates the blood throughout the body, distributes the blood drug throughout the body. If the blood takes that drug to the liver goes to work on it immediately to inactivate it, to put it in a form that can be eliminated, and it'll usually be eliminated in the urine. And if it goes into the kidney will take steps to get it out of the body. The body is a very conservative sort of organism, all told, because it likes things just the way they are, and it doesn't like it when we do something that changes our biology. The body likes our blood pressure at a certain point, at a certain level. It likes the acidity of our blood at a certain level. It likes our electrolyte contents at a certain level, and so on. And we take some drugs that change this, and the body will interact here with it. While all of this is going on, some of the drug is finding its way to what we call a receptor that would exist on a membrane and that would recognize the chemistry, the chemical nature of a given drug. And if the recognition is right in kind of a lock and key formulation, the drug will settle in on that receptor, and there'll be a series of biological events here that will produce the response that is characteristic of that drug. So we have the drug that comes in contact with the receptor, it forms this complex, and then we get in that slick, and then we get the response. And so that's basically how any drug that we take is performing its function. It's important when you're trying to come to grips with over-the-counter medicines as well to understand that the conditions for which over-the-counter drugs are intended are conditions that are generally self-limiting. That is, you're going to get over these things in time anyway. A cold will go away in about a week. A sprain will get better over a period of days to weeks. And another way of saying this is that over-the-counter drugs don't cure anything. They're not intended to cure. They are intended to relieve symptoms. They're intended for conditions that can be safely self-diagnosed. You're not health professionals, you're not physicians, but you know when you have a cold, you know when your eye is itchy, you know, and so you can diagnose your conditions and seek out the medication on your own. And it's also generally assumed that the drugs for self-medication are safe and effective, but I've already shown that there's some problems with this assumption. I want to make the point here, I don't want to go through all of this, this is self-evident, I already said this, that OTC remedies don't cure anything. It's important that you read what's on the label, that you take the drug as directed, but I want to make a special point about generic drugs. I'm a big proponent of generic medications, be they prescription or over-the-counter. There is now no good reason not to at least try generic medications, at least as far as over-the-counter drugs are concerned. There was a time when there was concern that they might not be the same chemically, but that's a done issue now. As far as the FDA is concerned, all drugs that come into this country under the auspices of the Food and Drug Act must be manufactured to within a very precise set of standards. The other issue with regard to generic drugs centered around their biological activity. How well did they work once they were in the body? And there were some genuine concerns here and legitimate concerns, but there's been plenty of study in this area now, and there's been great documentation of many drugs, and more drugs are being documented every year in terms of showing that they are biologically equivalent. That is, they behave just as well as the brand name drugs. Where a person may want to be careful about switching from one brand to a generic, or even from one generic brand to another generic brand, is in the case of prescription medications that you're on a continuous basis, a thyroid medication, for example. There might be subtle differences in the way one generic brand performs in the body compared to another, and it might be enough to just throw off the balance if there's a change like this. But this isn't something that relates to over-the-counter drugs, because no over-the-counter drug on the market is intended to be used for more than 2 weeks, some for much shorter periods than that. Okay? So that's kind of an entry into this realm. Now let's talk a little specifically about dietary supplements. What is a dietary supplement? It's defined under the law as something that contains a dietary ingredient intended to supplement the diet, a food. This screams at us, food. Dietary ingredients include vitamins, minerals, herbs, so on, a whole host of things that would fall into this category. And I've already said that the FDA views these things as foods. The problem is that promoters of these substances, these products, often invite consumers to view them as safe and effective drugs. And they do this without calling them drugs. We'll examine a label here that will give evidence of this, and that's really where the problem lies. Let's compare the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. Under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, over-the-counter and prescription drugs must be proven safe and effective by the manufacturer. This is to the satisfaction of the Food and Drug Administration. They must be manufactured according to established standards of purity. The package must list the quantities of all of the ingredients. The manufacturers must report product-related issues. They must be able to track their production batches. They must disclose information on safety and efficacy to the FDA and to consumers. Contrast this with the case under the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. Until recently, none of these were required by this law. Now we have at least a standard for the way products are manufactured according to a standard of purity. Package labels must also list the quantities of ingredients, but there's a way around this for a manufacturer. This is the so-called proprietary blend, and I'll show you an example here. Here is a label from a dietary supplement for St. John's wort. What do people take St. John's wort for?
Sunburn.
Depression. You're thinking this is a drug, okay? But it's being sold as a dietary supplement, but it's being used as a drug, and it's effective. There, the clinical literature supports the use of St. John's wort to treat mild depression, not severe depression that can put you in the hospital, but the mild kind of depression that we all get from time to time. It's effective in this context. Here is the label from that package. And if you were to read it, first of all, just looking at it, this doesn't look like a label from an over-the-counter product. It looks like one from a bread wrapper. Yeah. We've got something here that lists the ingredients. We've got a discussion here that doesn't, if you take the time to read it, you'll see that it really tells you nothing about what this is for and how to use it. That's because the law doesn't permit them to say this is an antidepressant, because if they said it was an antidepressant, then it would be covered under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and then the manufacturer would have to spend a lot of money to demonstrate that it's safe and effective. in this context, they can sell this product without having to demonstrate that it's safe and effective. Here's the proprietary blend. What does proprietary mean in a manufacturing sense?
Secret.
This is a secret. This is a secret formula. They do not have to disclose how much of these things are in here, and they don't have to disclose why these things are in here. I have no clue why most of these things are in this product. The proprietary blend is there in a total of 375 milligrams. Now, if you were to take this, if you were depressed, and you heard about this about St. John's wort, and you felt that you wanted to check this out, and you took this to your physician or to your pharmacist, and you said, I've heard about St. John's wort, I would like some additional information here, what do you think? Is this product going to work for me? If I was the pharmacist that you brought this to, I would look at this and I would say, well, St. John's wort might work for you in this context, but I can't tell whether this product's going to work because I don't know how much of the active ingredient St. John's wort is here. It's something less than 375 milligrams because everything else is here. And what do you know about food labels and the list of ingredients?
The one with the most is at the top.
That's right. So St. John's wort is here in the greatest amount. We know that. And everything else is in decreasing amounts. But we have no clue how much St. John's wort is here. What we do know from the clinical studies is that you need about 900 milligrams of St. John's wort a day to expect an effect in the treatment of mild depression. The dose is given up here. Take 2 to 4 capsules 2 times a day. But again, if we don't know how much St. John's wort is here, we don't know whether we're getting, in the course of a day, if we're getting 900 milligrams. Okay? This is not an isolated example. This is the case for every dietary supplement, except the ones in which there is only one ingredient. If St. John's wort was the only thing there, then they would have to tell us how much is there. Then we're in a position to be able to say whether or not this thing might be effective. So the first lesson that I would urge you to take from this discussion is to avoid any dietary supplement that is a proprietary blend.
Isn't it rather significant where it says in the asterisk, daily value not established? I guess you've got it in the right corner, but...
Well, sure. But that goes with... They have to do this because it's a dietary supplement, okay. and we're talking about something that supposedly needs to be added to the diet, but we don't even know how much of it should be added to the diet. Okay. So, some key points to take away here. Be aware of this unique legal niche that is occupied by dietary supplements in the United States. Don't take for granted the things that we all take for granted about prescription and over-the-counter drugs, that they're safe, that they're effective, that they're pure, and that we're getting adequate dosage. And don't take for granted that what you read about them in the promotional literature or see on the web or wherever you see it in magazines, that it's true. You want to examine these things with a very critical eye before you decide to buy them. Here's where the problem is. Where are you going to get your information? And this is, it's caveat emptor, buyer beware, where dietary supplements are concerned. Some physicians are knowledgeable on the subject of dietary supplements. Some aren't. Many aren't. Some pharmacists are knowledgeable. Some aren't. Many aren't. There are some good websites. MayoClinic.com is a good website for looking at some dietary supplements. You can go look at that site. It's free, and you might get some information that you need there. But I would be very, very careful about the way I bought dietary supplements. I would certainly not buy a dietary supplement from the guy who's, or I wouldn't get my information about the dietary supplement from the person who's trying to sell it to me. Now, just a word about the truth in advertising, something that I've, over the years, I've called the half-truth hustle. And this was something that goes back to the days of our multivitamins. There was a time, probably back in the 60s, 1960s and 70s, when multivitamins were being sold as stress formulas. You lead a stressful life, everybody was leading a stressful life in those days, and you need, and that means you need vitamins. And this was a big marketing deal for multivitamins. And the half-truth here, this is all based on a half-truth. The half-truth was that stress increases the body's need for vitamins. That's true. Stress increases the body's need for vitamins. The hustle was that, therefore, because stress increases the body's need for vitamins, everyone should take a vitamin supplement, one a day, okay, to make sure that this stress is controlled. The whole truth was that it's physical stress that increases a person's need for vitamins. A broken bone, pregnancy, these kinds of things increase the need for vitamins. Mental stress doesn't. At least there's no evidence that I'm aware of that mental stress, job stress, increases one's need for vitamins. If you're not eating an adequate diet, you may need vitamins. And maybe you're not eating an adequate diet because your boss doesn't give you time to eat, you know, or you're in such a state of mind. Well, that's another situation. But just the fact that that you're under stress and you eat a normal United States reasonably balanced diet where most of our foods is fortified with vitamins already anyway, this is a non-issue. And this has all gone away. This is no longer a promotional ploy for multivitamins. Where it's a promotional ploy now is in for dietary supplements. I picked two supplements here made by the same company. They actually have the same ingredients here, and they are they have stress in their name. They are for stress. The half truth here is they say on their label up to 90% of doctor visits are stress related. That's true. That's data from the CDC. This stuff, Carcuma xanthoriza, which is the main ingredient in this product, has been shown to alleviate symptoms associated with stress. These are the half truths. These can be verified. The hustle is that it's the same as with the vitamins, only it's just taken a little bit further. If you're under stress, then you need to take this stuff because this will help you to deal with this stress. People have been doing this for thousands of years with these herbs, according to them. The whole truth is that the stress that's referred to in this scientific work is something called oxidative stress, which is just a term for a biochemical sort of reaction. It's not a harmful process. Oxidative stress is just something that happens within biochemical reactions. It can be associated with injury of tissue, but it can also be associated with healing of tissue. Oxidative stress is just a complicated sort of biochemical process. Moreover, these were studies that had been done in animals, that there was no correlation directly to human situation, and the dosage was usually much higher than is found in these products. Which brings up another point. When you do get an idea of how much of what the dosage is that's needed for a given supplement to produce a given pharmacologic effect, and you look at the products that are available, very often you're going to find that the dosage that's included in the product is way below what's needed for the therapeutic or the pharmacologic action. Now, why do you suppose that is? This occurs very, very frequently within this realm of dietary supplements. The FDA doesn't let manufacturers get away with that with the conventional over-the-counter drugs. The documented therapeutically effective dose must be what's there. It can be in the low range of what's documented as effective, but it has to be something that's been documented for the over-the-counter drugs. But for the dietary supplements, the FDA doesn't regulate dosage, and so most of these manufacturers, many of them, will put subtherapeutic concentrations in there, or dosages in there. Why do you suppose that is? If you were a manufacturer...
To protect themselves?
Of course. If you were a manufacturer, the last thing you want is to get sued. You don't want to hurt anybody. And so that's probably what's at work here. Okay, we'll just move on. Now, so what about this idea of these products, these herbs for stress? They make the claim that all of these things have been used, have been taken by men and women over the centuries for stress. Well, here are this product. Here is another product from another manufacturer. Here's another one from another. Here's another for another. They all claim that everything that's in these products is effective in the treatment of stress. If you look at this, there's a little cross-pollination here. American ginseng is in three of them. Eleuthero is in two of them. But most of them don't match. And so, I mean, are we supposed to take from this that they're all useful against in the treatment of stress? I think not. So there's an issue here. Now, with regard to the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, I'll just reiterate. Federal law does not require proof of safety. It does not require F standards of purity. The labels need list only ingredients. They don't have to, whatever they claim on the label does not have to be proven accurate or truthful, although there's a limit on what they can put on the label. FDA approval is not required before marketing. They don't have to disclose information about safety. They may not be marketed as a treatment or a cure for a specific disease. They may not be marketed to alleviate symptoms of a disease. But they still do. They still market them this way. They just don't say so on the label. The FDA reviews the labels, and as resources permit, this is what a quote that I got from the FDA, an FDA person, as resources permit, they will go after erroneous advertising associated with dietary supplements, but this is really low on the list of priorities for them. Here is an example of some of the claims that are permitted. They can say that something maintains a healthy circulatory system. You'll see that for ginkgo biloba. For hot flashes, you'll see that for black cohosh. It helps you relax. That'll be valerian or kava kava. But these are not medical statements. These are just statements that are general. And the FDA has said, okay, we'll let you do that. But we also have to put on the label a statement that says that the FDA, this is the statement that is any statement on the label has not been evaluated by the FDA. The problem with this, of course, is that the FDA can't check on all these, and there's a way around this law in the first place. If they can't say this is good for your kidney function, they can't say this is good for depression, they can't say this is good for pain relief, what they can do is what they've done, which is to put in the name of the product. These are the brand names of a whole bunch of products that I found in the stores. So they call it artery. And so that's supposed to tell the person who's looking for something for their arteries, for their circulation, for their colon, and so forth. This is the way around this notion that that they can't make therapeutic claims. All of these are proprietary blends.
What's women's transformation?
Yeah, I was wondering.
I have no idea.
Can we get some? What do we transform into?
I have no clue what that is. Okay. Now I had mentioned that the dietary supplement law does not establish or enforce standards of quality or quantity. And wherever there's standards like that that are lax, there are going to be consequences. And we can document these consequences. Here's a list of potential consequences. There may be too little or no active ingredient. There may be too much active ingredient. There may be the wrong ingredient. There may be dangerous or illegal ingredients. There may be contamination like dirt or filth, animal filth, and so forth. And right on down the line. There's a company that has come into play in the last decade or so. It's called consumerlab.com. And they have a website. And you can go there. Some of their information is free. Some they would like to have you subscribe in order to get. But what they're doing is what the FDA pretty much can't do at the moment. It's not that the FDA won't do it, it's just that they're not able to monitor dietary supplements for purity and for contaminants and so forth. And they've been doing this now for easily 10 years, and they publish their information. And in some respects, this has become, what they do has become sort of like the Better Housekeeping seal of approval for these dietary supplements. In fact, some of the manufacturers now are even submitting their products to ConsumerLab.com. And when ConsumerLab does their analysis, and if everything proves out that it's what they say is in there is actually in there, they're not doing proprietary blends. They're looking at the individual ingredient products. Then this is good, because at least then there is this information that that for this product or for these products, they have what in them what they say they have, and there's nothing else in there to create problems. Here is just a sampling of the kind of information that was obtained by ConsumerLab.com for analysis of products that contain these various substances, ranging from vitamins through metals like zinc, and then a whole bunch of herbal products. And while some of them came through with flying colors, where none of them failed the analysis, of the 215 that are listed here, 1 in 3 failed the analysis. That is, they didn't have the labeled amount of melatonin in the, or that melatonin did okay. The milk thistle product didn't have the labeled amount of what was supposed to be in there. It wasn't in the product, or there was a contamination. They find mercury, they find lead, they find all sorts of things in these products. And if this was the case, if these kinds of numbers came up in the FDA's analysis of prescription drugs and conventional over-the-counter drugs, there would be hell to pay. Those manufacturers would be in big-time trouble, and there would be drugs that would be yanked off the market until the problem was solved. Doesn't happen with dietary supplements, because FDA doesn't have any control in this context. So the bottom line here is that it's fair to assume therapeutic claims for dietary supplements are going to be exaggerated and often based on half-truths. I think if you go in with that bias, then you're not going to get nailed. You can always do what you can to check on the claims that are being made, but don't take them at face value. Also, it's fair to assume that the FDA is not going to act on the claims that are being made unless there's a pressing reason. A pressing reason would be when people are getting hurt. There was, do anybody remember when L-tryptophan was in the news? L-tryptophan was the remarkable new sleep aid that came on the market that is just an amino acid, is about as safe as it could get, and it was selling like hotcakes, and a lot of it came in, a bunch of it came in from somewhere in Japan, I think it was in Japan, and 20 or 30 people died, and that was the end of L-tryptophan's foray into the market. And the FDA jumped on them for this. But so it has to be a pressing reason where dietary supplements are concerned. You can also expect that recommended dosages are going to be low. In some cases, we don't even know what is an adequate dosage for some of these herbal remedies because it just hasn't been studied. You can assume that labeled ingredients and amounts may not be accurate. ConsumerLab.com has demonstrated this and continues to demonstrate it. And you can assume that prices for these things are going to be high. Okay, that's a whirlwind tour through dietary supplements. And I told you I hope that you would see what the problem is with dietary supplements. You'll notice that I have not really said anything about whether or not any of these herbal products do what is claimed. We can talk about a little of that tomorrow if anybody is interested. But before we even get to a discussion of the individual products, we have to contend with the fact that that what we buy on the shelf may not even contain that product. Or if it contains the product, it may contain something else. Or if it says it contains, in each capsule, 100 milligrams, maybe it contains 50 milligrams. Maybe it contains 100, maybe it contains 150. There's no way to know. Okay. So, any questions about dietary supplements? Yes?
I just wanted to reinforce that one slide that you had with the big letters "may" on it. It was a couple slides back, "may." The word "may" is in a lot of the descriptive portions, and it's a big clue when it's making claims. So it just says "may." A lot of people take it to be, you know, this is what it's going to do. It's one of your, like, two or three slides from the end.
Okay.
But that's a big clue, is if some the word "may" is in there, that
there it is.
Yeah,
the last one. Yeah. May contain.
Yeah.
And so it says may be useful for such and such.
Right.
That is an indication that it's not been proven at all.
Right. It's very important that you appreciate this notion that there is no guarantee for a dietary supplement. There just isn't. And maybe there will be in one day. I'm aware of dietary supplements produced by manufacturers who are actually paying on their own. They are paying for clinical studies to demonstrate that their product does what they would like to say that it does. And I give them credit for doing that. There's also, however, as a scientist myself, and I know about publications, and I know that negative data doesn't get published, so some manufacturers may be paying for studies as well, and when the studies come back and they say, well, this isn't doing what you thought it was doing, oh, thank you, and that's the last we hear of it.
Right.
Yes?
Kind of a different question. Is there any data, you're a scientist, you've studied this, about, you talked about physical harm, the physical harm that pharmaceuticals have done over the years, and I'm not lobbying or I'm just being a devil's advocate, have done to people over the years for various types of pharmaceuticals versus supplements.
Oh, no, absolutely. No drug is absolutely safe. All drugs are poisons. And the laws that we have, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, came about in 1938. There was an effort to get it established that began with the very first Food and Drug Law in 1906. And it took 32 years because that law was immediately recognized as being inadequate. And there was an effort to bring it up to snuff. And it was fought tooth and nail by the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association of that day. And it wasn't until 1938 that it passed, and the only reason that it passed in 1938 was because we had a disaster. In 1938 we were beginning to have some of the very earliest antibiotic drugs. The sulfa drugs were produced in that realm, and a batch of sulfa drugs was developed by a company in Ohio, and it was a big company, and innocently, the chemist that was in charge of putting this stuff into a palatable solution to be given to kids used as a solvent ethylene glycol. Now, do you know what ethylene glycol is?
Antifreeze.
Now, this was innocent, and this particular man, killed himself after this. But this was because no one really understood about the toxicity. Toxicology was not a science as well developed then as it is now. And so we had this disaster. And 160 children, mostly children, died. They died because they had taken this medicine. Congress said, this law passes today. And the law passed. It took another disaster in 1962 to get the next step, major step in the development of that law that would establish efficacy. The 1938 law really established safety requirements. But whether or not a company had to prove that their drug was effective didn't come into the law until 1962. And that only came about because of the thalidomide disaster. When I mentioned this to my medical students, at least before I retired a few years ago, they're now of the age that they don't even know what thalidomide was. And that's a tragedy, that they don't understand what thalidomide was. Is anybody who does not know what thalidomide was? This was the drug that caused horrendous birth defects. Children were born with no arms, no legs. Many died, but many survived. And that was in 1962, so do the numbers. Those kids are still around.
What was it for?
It was a sedative. And it was a sedative that was deemed to be safe. It was well studied, and it was safe. It was deemed to be safe for use in pregnant women. And this was at a time when we didn't really understand the relationship between drugs and pregnancy, and drugs and birth defects. And so there were thousands of these babies born around the world. Not very many in this country. Does anybody know this story? This is an FDA success story. There was a woman, physician, who worked for FDA. FDA, she'd just begun. Can't think of her name. She recently died. And she was given the assignment. She was brand new into the company. She was given the assignment of helping to spur this thing through the approval process through the FDA, because this thing had already been used all around the world, in Europe and elsewhere, and looked to be a wonderful drug. And she looked at the data and she said, well, I'm not so sure about this. It had something to do with neuronal changes in nerve function in some rats. And so she said, no, send it back to the company. We want some more information. The manufacturers went berserk. They tried all sorts of influence techniques to get her decision overridden. To the FDA's credit, they did not override this woman's hesitancy. While the new data were being gathered and the fighting was still going on about this, the news broke in Europe about the birth defects. And within weeks, this drug was quietly withdrawn from consideration by the manufacturer. And the only people in this country who were affected to any significant degree were wives, pregnant wives of physicians, because the company had passed out samples of the drug to physicians to kind of get them tuned in to what a wonderful drug this was going to be. Their wives took it, and they had these babies. And immediately, the 1962 amendment went into effect. And now every drug has to be tested for birth defects. And in most cases, even if we don't know whether it causes birth defects or we think that it doesn't, we still say, don't take it if you're pregnant. So, I forget where I was going with all that. Oh, that was your point about the prescription drugs that are harmful. And this is something that just has to be weighed. We have to weigh risks against benefits. And with prescription drugs, no question that people suffer.
I just want to point out that you also see the word "may" on the back of most pharmaceuticals. Yeah. You may vomit, you may die, you may,
sure,
et cetera.
Yeah, well, the law requires them to put everything down. Yeah. And you know, it scares the bejesus out of everybody that reads it. If I say, don't read it. Any other questions?
I have a question. There's a growing trend, especially I think marketed towards women, for cosmeceuticals. They're not systemic, but they're topical.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, gosh, everything from teenage girls with their acne.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we'll touch on some of that tomorrow.
You will.
Yeah. It's not so much in the realm of cosmeceuticals. It's still an over-the-counter drug.
It's over-the-counter.
Yeah.
But they make claims that you know, and yeah. I was just wondering, so you'll touch on that tomorrow.
Sure, not every drug gets absorbed through the skin, and so the topical application of many drugs is a safe way to apply them, but but there are drugs that get absorbed as well.
Like retin-A.
Yeah, well, retin-A is a nasty little one, but but it, you know, it does, it works. Retin-A is a nice one, a nice example, because it's very effective in the treatment of acne, but it's got some pretty serious side effects. Anyway, well, I'll let you